Dove Creek, a novel read by the author Paula Coomer and brought to you by KRFP in Moscow, Idaho.
Mystery, mystery, behind the veil, surprise me. Confound me. Surround me.
This is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either products of the author's imagination or used in a fictional way. Any resemblance to actual locales or persons, living or dead, is entirely coincidental.
Patricia helps Elmer to the clinic. She becomes emotionally involved with one of her patients and investigates a TB outbreak. I don't know when I began kissing his cheek at the end of my visits, but when Vance told me the worst thing about losing use of his hands was the inability to hold a book, I started showing up on Thursday afternoons with a copy of Craig Leslie's Winter Kill. A story of Indians and non-Indians in rodeos in and around the Umatilla Reservation in Oregon. It was my last stop of the day, and I read until I was hoarse. Sometimes the TV was on, silent but tuned to a black-and-white movie. Vance liked old Japanese films and Japanese history. Once I teased him about past lives. You were probably a samurai, isn't it? When he told me about his dream to go to law school, I put him in touch with disability services at the University of Idaho in Moscow, a 45-mile climb out of the Clearwater and Snake River Canyons to a rolling body of land called the Palouse. After months of excited talk, however, Vance admitted he wasn't going to have the energy for it. The day after my visit to the Rubidoux, I came early and without Winter Kill. I had my binder of report forms and a testing kit, TB syringes, alcohol swabs, latex gloves, a vial of purified protein derivative serum tuberculin, or PPD. I tested his nursing assistant, left orders for the home health nurse to collect a sputum sample from Vance, since his altered immunity made him a logical candidate for active TB. We agreed that I should return in 2 days to assess the assistant's site. He would invite his family and extended community to be there so I might test them, which meant Saturday. Not as unpleasant as a mud flow in the clinic basement and the only off time I had donated in 2 years on the job. The hardest part would be hiding my affection for Vance in the face of other people who loved him. And Vance was incredulous at this development. No one in his family was sick. Talk of dying babies made him cry and reminisce. His days of breaking ponies, the auto accident that broke his neck the first time, the damage beyond the trauma leading to ankylosing spondylitis, the indignity of being young and paraplegic, the prednisone to fight the AS interrupting his immune system, his own body turning renegade against itself, compounding everything with rheumatoid arthritis. Then the Indian Health Service shower chair, a $30 piece of equipment wired together, rusting through at the legs, and a tired IHS home visit nurse who failed to requisition a new one, daring fate to deliver the morning the chair gave way, spilling Vance and his peppermint stick bones onto the shower floor in a C4 fracture, then Vance, thrust into the nightmare of quadriplegia, salvation and victimization rolled into one. A 29-year-old unusable body stabilized to preserve a brain's potential, a heart's. I gave him sips of cranberry juice to maintain his urine pH, keep monster bacteria off his catheter. His feet, face, hands, puffed and scaled. From what? The docs asked one another. Prednisone? Riders? But no one, Vance said. No one in his family was sick. On Sunday, I loaded Brett and Zach, safe from flitting TB germs since no one was symptomatic, in an igloo of blue ice and serum into the Honda and headed to Lapway to place PPDs on 32 relatives and friends of the Weasel household and therefore of Josh and Corinne Rubidoux, a cadre of faces I'd not previously connected with this family, cousins, nephews, nieces, half-brothers, stepsisters, grandnieces, uncles, now with nicknames I'd never before heard, Moss, Lucky, Stickbone, Bozo. Also, as always, people cooperated, no questions asked. Some asked me to test their blood pressure or blood sugar, made appointments for me to stop by and see Uncle or check up on Auntie. I repeated the same interview nearly 30 times. When was your last PPD? Have you coughed blood, had recent fever, chills, night sweats, any unexplained weight loss? Anyone you know had a chest x-ray lately or think they might have TB? Have prolonged illness of any kind? Do you buy your milk at the store, from a farmer or co-op? When was the last time you held the Rubidoux babies? When was your last chest x-ray? Brett and Zach played video games in a back room with the younger ones. Vernon was finding my sons intolerable, so I dared not leave them with him. Besides that, just the week before, Leonard Wahoven told me Vernon had showed up in our office looking for me with booze on his breath and Brett in tow. I think they like us, Mom, Zach said, Advance's young nieces and nephews. By the end of the day, after hours of swiping arms with towelettes, slipping finely tuned needles bevel up just under the tender dermis of the inner forearm, the volar aspect, injecting 0.1 cc of serum to make a pea-sized wheel, I had 32 signed TB consent forms and 32 epidemiology report forms, but no one with symptoms. No index case, no dwindling, gray-skinned, distant relative hacking bloody chunks of lung into an empty Folgers can. I walked down the uncarpeted hallway to Vance's bedroom, where he lay surrounded by the paraphernalia of disease, and thankfully had had the good foresight to remain for the afternoon's activities. Nothing, I told him, and I don't feel like any of these people is going to show positive. Vance looked at me, his empathic gaze nearly lost in the folds of a handsome face hammered into moonscape from its angry battle with prednisone. Before he could speak, Mrs. Rubidoux stepped through the door. "Excuse me," she said quietly, "but we just thought of somebody." Arthur Jackson also lived alone in a trailer, this one at a park on the west end of Lapway, not far from the second Bigfoot sighting. And he had the cure for TB. He told me about this after I'd planted PPDs on 15 construction workers at a building site in central Lapway, traveled to nearby Clarkston, Washington, to Tom Smith's, a newsstand and card room, where blackjack and poker games filled up lazy Snake River Valley afternoons and pull tabs could be purchased, to interview and test a handful of Indian and non-Indian cronies of Elmer Joe's, one of whom was said to be prone to coughing spasms and had lost a conspicuous amount of weight. After Mrs. Rubidoux revealed her children's grandmother on the Yakima Reservation in central Washington had indeed been quite ill, as had several other members of that household, where the Rubidoux family lived for 4 weeks the previous summer. After 5 active cases of TB were diagnosed in the neighborhood, and after even a Forest Service firefighter near the Warm Springs Reservation in Oregon had been diagnosed. Arthur was the remaining link between the construction workers, the card players, the Rubidoux, Vance's family, and the firefighter. And having visited him on occasion to talk about his diabetes, I knew him to be inordinately thin. But he also smoked incessantly, lived only on senior meals delivered out of the tribal senior center, and beer. His skin was taut, weathered, but without the grayish cast I was looking for, and he swore he'd never spit up blood. I'd been trying to catch him for weeks, and when I finally did and explained my need to test him for TB, he insisted he couldn't possibly have the disease and proved it by unzipping his pants and lifting his shirt to reveal row after parallel row of white adhesive tape circling his torso, spaced maybe 2 inches apart from pubis to nipple line. His brown skin stood out stark as prison stripes. This was his protection, he said. He also cured his diabetes by eating adhesive tape and wondered if I could get him some. The real kind, from Valley Foods, not the clinic, he said. I looked at the wrinkled corners of Arthur's eyes and the dark brown irises and considered the trade. $5 worth of adhesive tape in exchange for one more TB test. I just couldn't see myself walking to Valley Foods, across a paved street, a paved parking lot, a paved alley, and another paved parking lot, writing a check for my U.S. Public Health Service salary, the earning of which increasingly seemed to be exacting something from me, to buy adhesive tape for Arthur. The young clerk would wonder. Everyone knew the public health nurse had a free, endless supply of surgical tape in her nurse's bag, in the back of her Jeep, in her office, in the clinic storeroom. What would I have told her? That I had patients who drank holy water to cure heart failure, ate roots to cure sinus infections, sat in sweat houses for their spiritual ails, but I'd only just learned that adhesive tape could ward off TB and cure diabetes, that my Grandma Hattie, dead all these years from diabetes and cancer, might be alive if only I'd known. Promising to return with real adhesive tape, I drew up the serum to instill in his forearm and summon the required wheel, while he explained that the tape for diabetes only worked if you folded it tight into tiny squares before you swallow it, and that for TB, once you had it lined up right around your body, you were never to remove and redo it. You can die from eating tape, Arthur. You know that. I tell you, he said, it's tape. You eat the tape. Arthur, if you get constipated, you call me. No bowel movement, you call, I said. Then on second thought, never mind, Arthur, I'll be back tomorrow. Just be home, same time as today. Just be home. My next stop was Elmer Joe's, but he wasn't there. Scotty Walter and some others were headed for the sweat lodge. The dogs were gone. Scotty said Elmer had broken his hip and was staying with family in Oregon. Why didn't I know? I asked him. But he only shook his head and said someone tried to call. I looked around at Elmer's old silver trailer. I felt lost, like I wanted a coffee and my change purse was empty. Since it was Thursday, I decided to head to Vance's with Winterkill and read a while. Instead, we sat talking, me sipping a Diet Coke, giving Vance his sips of cranberry juice until his brother came home from work. I didn't tell him about Arthur's adhesive tape, but I considered unrolling a dozen or so acres of it and clothing his decrepit body in it, or dicing it into pancakes or cookies and feeding it to him until life was wonderful for him again, until all the big black things badgering his body shriveled and were gone. The Coeur d'Alene agency offices are 85 miles north of Lewiston in the town of Plummer, a community of 1,500 Indians and non-Indians surrounded by Rocky Mountain foothills. Plummer is home to the Towhee Medical Center, an award-winning clinic founded by the Coeur d'Alene tribe. In June of 1990, the Coeur d'Alenes became one of the first tribes to provide health care for non-Indian patients. In 1994, they opened a 12,000-square-foot addition housing a 5-chair dental operatory, mental health and public health programs, environmental health, administrative offices, and a 100-person capacity conference room. Nearby buildings housed outpatient substance abuse programs and alternative therapy services. In 1998, the tribe opened the Towhee Well-Being Center, which features a full-service athletic club with indoor running and basketball courts, swimming and hydrotherapy pools, a physical therapy center, and cardiac rehabilitation. The programs are solvent, even though fees for the uninsured are determined by sliding scale. And both facilities are groundbreaking. The Well-Being Center is the first of its kind and financed entirely with grants. The medical center is the first to be built by combining federal community health block grants and IHS monies. All this fewer than 100 years after the practice of disallowing intermarriage with non-Indians and other tribes left the Coeur d'Alenes so vulnerable to disease they were nearly annihilated. In addition to the Towhee Medical Center, the Coeur d'Alenes operate forestry, fishing, logging, and farming operations, a grocery and hardware store, several gas station mini-marts, and a nationally recognized casino, resort, and golf course. They've tried several times to grow industrial hemp for a fiber and paper mill, but the feds keep shutting that innovation down. Unlike the Nez Perce, for whom the Presbyterian Church is a strong community presence, the Coeur d'Alenes have long been influenced by the Jesuits. The mission at De Smet, 15 miles south of Plummer, has been central to the tribe's spirituality. The original mission at Cataldo, 90 miles north and east of Plummer, is the oldest building in Idaho, built with huge virgin timbers, walls covered with grass, clay, and mud. Tribal people carried rocks for the foundation out of the mountains on their backs. Some believe Father De Smet, the Jesuit who built the mission, fulfilled the prophecy of Chief Circling Raven, whose spirit guide was a raven who warned the chief when the Blackfeet were about to attack or advised him where to send his hunters to find buffalo. One day the raven predicted the coming of Black Robes, who would bring spiritual power and prowess to the Sheshumsh. Circling Raven died long before Father De Smet arrived in 1842, but the people remembered this prophecy. The tribe lived in peace with the Jesuits until 1860, when the U.S. government built the Mullen Road from Montana to Walla Walla in southern Washington. This brought hundreds of settlers to the prairies of the Coeur d'Alenes, followed by the Gold Rush, and so many whites that the chiefs and priests began scouting new land for the mission. They chose what is now the village of De Smet, a place the Coeur d'Alenes knew as Nilhuach, or opening in the woods, where the big black thing supposedly claimed residence. It was a place the tribe had never before lived, rather camped briefly in summer to dig camas, a starchy food staple. Everyone was sad to leave the beauty of Cataldo, but no homesteaders cluttered the Nilhuach, and so the new mission was built. The Coeur d'Alenes originally called themselves Sheshumsh, meaning the ones that were found here. Their ancestors trapped furs to trade with the French. The Sheshumsh drove such a hard bargain, traders began calling them Coeur d'Alenes, or sharp-pointed hearts. Original Sheshumsh land ranged through most of what is now North Idaho and eastern Washington. By 1895, the Spokane and Kalispell tribes had also been squeezed off their lands to the north, and Chief Celtis invited them to live in Coeur d'Alene territory. Not long after, in 1889, new treaties drove all three tribes to the southern edge of their previous holdings, requiring the Coeur d'Alenes to sell away their greatest source of spirit and sustenance, what is known in modern day as Lake Coeur d'Alene. It would be many years before the Spokane and the Kalispell were allotted small parcels of their own original ground, so in essence, Chief Celtis's action preserved both tribes. Today there are few full-blood members of any of the three, forcing people to choose a tribe with which to enroll, the blood of their mothers or the blood of their fathers. If there is disregard between the Nez Perce and the Coeur d'Alenes, it's connected to Steptoe Butte, 10 miles east of Plummer across the Washington state line. It's the only place the Coeur d'Alenes engaged with the U.S. Army, and they are said to have beat up a Colonel Wright and 150 soldiers who, carting two cannons and led by Nez Perce guides, had stumbled into the Coeur d'Alenes digging roots. A wrongful rumor having to do with Nez Perce guides leading the way for the Army to swipe out the Sheshumsh so the Nez Perce could claim the land. A cadre of Coeur d'Alene malcontents convinced the Spokane and the Palouse to help drive off the army. The Coeur d'Alene chief, Vincent, and a Father Josette tried to prevent the attack, but the whooping and fist-shaking escalated on its own until a rifle shot killed a popular Coeur d'Alene man. Within minutes, 7 soldiers and 3 Coeur d'Alenes were dead. Wright and his men fled, but were overpowered and imprisoned. Most of the Coeur d'Alenes voted to free the soldiers, but the Palouse wanted them killed. Chief Vincent and Father Josette and others of like mind spirited the men to safety in the night.
You've been listening to Paula Coomer, reading from her novel, Dove Creek.
All the oxen free, come out from behind the tree.
Patricia solves the TB mystery, but only after weeks of investigation and coordination with other agencies. A Nez Perce man uses adhesive tape to cure his diabetes. Patricia considers the history of the Coeur d'Alene people. The tribe afterwards divided, and many moved back to Cataldo, hoping for peace. When the army came to punish Wright's attackers, the tribes refused to engage. The soldiers had newer and more accurate rifles. Rather than fight a futile battle, the Cataldo faction of the tribe set fire to the prairie grass to stampede the army's horses. Wright's way of getting even was to march his men west through Spokane and burn the houses and barns of the Coeur d'Alenes who lived along the Spokane River. He then caught up with a herd of 800 horses belonging to the Palouse Indians and killed all 800 in one day. Wright later hanged 15 Palouse warriors and the Palouse war leader, Qualcheen, who arrived under a white flag. In 1858, 14 chiefs signed a treaty with Wright. The Coeur d'Alenes never fought the whites again. I was just past my 2-year anniversary at Lapway. My commissioning as a lieutenant for the USPHS had come through. I had my uniform and officer's hat, and I was awaiting confirmation of my transfer north to the Coeur d'Alenes to create and develop their community and public health nursing program. In the meantime, eager for new duties to adjunct the drill of home visits. I had arranged for the community health representatives to be certified on the AccuCheck 2s and had secured over 100 free machines for every diabetes patient who was willing to allow the CHRs to visit at least monthly. I'd finished coordinating forms and policies with Tamara Olson, the public health nurse at the satellite clinic in Kamiai, over whom I'd been given supervisory duties. I helped to create a diabetes clinic and diabetes education protocols. I'd searched for index cases and delivered hundreds of immune globulin injections for a dozen outbreaks of hepatitis A. I'd written a proposal for a new GSA Jeep Cherokee for Tamara, which she got. Ellen Barton, Lydia Yuknovich, and I also testified before officials from the Portland area office, requesting Tamara's position be upgraded from temporary part-time to permanent full-time, and won. I was precepting nursing students for Lewis Clark State College in Lewiston. But what I needed was evidence that any of it mattered. I had grown weary of monitoring chronic illness only to have people die anyway, was annoyed by my lack of technical polish in situations such as Elmer's, and although the TB investigation had been interesting, it was a little like Christmas letdown. All that motion and brain work, and then nothing. Even the dogs had gotten used to me for the most part. Even Cujo at Josie Yellowfeather's place didn't bark anymore. I tried to deny it to myself, but I had started to dread rounds, clumping them back to back, spending the remaining time in my new solo office, doors closed, answering phone calls from Zach's school, staring into space. I didn't even have Leonard Wahobin to dilute my melancholy, since Mr. Picone had retired, and the new sud had moved me to an office across from his, next to Amanda Alfred's telephone operations area. He was constantly flirting and inviting me out, and I hated it. I began to schedule my hours around his, reasoned that if I spent a full 8-to-5 schedule of visits on Monday, I could defend 4 hours of charting on Tuesday when he was gone to the weekly NEPTEC meeting. Brett and Zach had survived another summer with Mark and Tanya and her two children and were back in school. I vented my jealous heat around the clinic, telling anyone I could find about the expensive clothes Mark bought to replace my Shopko versions, the white Dodge Stealth, the trips to California when 2 years prior he'd never once been on a commercial airliner. Rob Joliet, one of our lab techs, finally labeled it for me, Disneyland Dad. One morning I was at my desk trying to design a new care plan format when I ran across notes from a pediatrics rotation at Oregon Health Sciences University in Portland, where I observed surgery on a 3-month-old named Devin, who suffered from transposition of the great vessels, or worm heart. TGV is common to crack babies, whereby there are holes in the septum dividing the atria and the ventricles, and the pulmonary artery and aorta are switched. It's a leaky, backward heart. But Devin wasn't a crack baby. No one knew why his heart had developed in such a way. And, at the time, the operation placed him at incredible risk. 50% of infants surviving open-heart surgery developed some measure of cerebral palsy. the sequelae, probably, of jimmy-rigging the body's core temperature to below 90 degrees to reduce the need for oxygen and nutrients during the procedure, or of diverting the patient's blood into the heart-lung machine, a sci-fi device which assumes the role of its fleshy counterparts, where oxygenation, anticoagulation, and nutrient titration occur a la invasion of the body snatchers, active life put on hold while passive life slips in. Once the boy recovered, he would be discharged to rehab specialists and home health nursing, followed by years of monitoring and therapy at the hands of early intervention specialists. A long haul for the body, mind, and spirit, for the child and for the family, but the alternative was certain death. I thought of mine as a warm heart, how I hadn't taken the time to imagine an aftermath beyond leaving Mark. I had grown anxious, given to shivering. Part of me floated in that mind space I'd momentarily inhabited at the Elk City cabin, dark and listless, reminiscent of a woman I once cared for whose uterus hung between her legs like a shriveled leather bag. Then my black government AT&T phone rang, causing me to jump so hard I swiveled over backward, nearly toppling my chair. Stan Franklin. Stan had a habit of calling when he was worried about his wife's blood sugar. He was a caring man, but afraid of being left behind, of Peach dying first. In fact, managing Peach's blood sugars became such a problem that Dr. Haskins and I devised a standing medical order allowing me to adjust her insulin dosage based on the week's average blood glucose level. Ideally, Peach would test herself morning and night, the record of which I retrieved from the AccuCheck's tiny memory. That particular morning, however, Stan's phone call was a little more frantic than usual. "I can't wake her up," he said. "I tried, and I shook her, but I just can't wake her up." Stan and Peach lived east of Lapway at a tiny settlement known as Sweetwater. Their home sat back from Garden Gulch Road's dirt lane on a parcel of perhaps 20 acres and was flanked by a 14-by-70 house trailer, circa 1970. White galvanized steel exterior, cheap aluminum windows, what we in the Tornado Belt referred to as a death trap, because they guaranteed just about that amount of safety. Outside, chained to a spike, a pair of growling mutts, one looking suspiciously like a Rottweiler and of dubious demeanor, the other maybe half collie, half German shepherd. They were the only dogs on my rounds to still antagonize me. One or the other of them lunged at his fetter every time I pulled the Cherokee up to the house. Even though they weren't close enough to create an exact risk, I maintained finger contact with my can of dog repellent. Sweetwater was not as treed and shadowy as Tom Beale Road, but at lunch I jogged down it, and certain spots felt quite edgy, as if vampires slept in the ditches waiting for sundown. Especially in late summer, in the heat of September and October, dust set upon every plant, dead car, farm machine, and animal, blanching the landscape. Purple lupine, dull as platter grapes, the scarlet of Indian paintbrush faded as an old bandana, as if frightened by its own contrast to the tan of harvested wheat, dead weeds, roadside grasses. I drove the dirt and gravel from Highway 95, wanting more than anything to put the Jeep into four-wheel drive and bury the pedal and get it over with. Squirrel down the long stretch, slide sideways around the corner, then straighten it out and continue as if nothing had happened. Make my visit with Stan and Peach, whistle as I drove back to the clinic, retrace the reverse of my antics, pretend all the while to be perfectly unafraid. Dear stomach. Inside Stan and Peach's house, air conditioning choking out the heat was a mix of traditional and modern. Floral sofa angled southward from the east window, the boundary between it and Stan's lazy boy, a small wooden table holding the things necessary to keep the two alive. Peach's AccuCheck too, a supply of syringes, alcohol swabs, cotton, Stan's nitroglycerin, the phone, a notepad and cup of pens. Usually when I arrived, both were seated, Peach in her calico house dress and foam-soled slippers, feet supported by a hooked rug stool, Rubbermaid container of corn husk weaving supplies nearby, replete with some utilitarian object in its creation stage. Stan reclining in the easy chair, wearing brogans, dress trousers, and dress shirt, hollering at me to come in, while trying to fasten his belt buckle with his feet up and a book in his lap. Occasionally they were watching TV. Peach was what is known as a brittle diabetic. Her blood sugar soared without notice, dropped just as quickly, and she was beginning to suffer the side effects of both. Retinal bleeding, heart disease, renal disorders. Her lower extremities were constantly swollen despite restrictive hosiery and regular periods of elevation. Still, with all her difficulties, she regularly traveled to Washington, D.C. and various points to display her weaving. In fact, was one of the few Nez Perce elder women left who was adept at the art. Her basketry was a marvel and an intrigue. Strands of dry leaf so compactly woven the vessel could hold water, the outside decorated in geometrics, the medium corn husk dyed with vegetables, or, for casual pieces, acrylic yarn. The honor I craved was to be awarded one of her baskets. The Nez Perce had a tradition of giving. People were constantly trying to give me things, and I knew no way to avoid accepting them, nor did I really want to. Beaded earrings and hair barrettes, food, flowers, photos. At the one-year anniversary of a tribal member's death, a ritual known as a giveaway memorialized and honored the life of the deceased. I was invited to several, but only attended one. When Esther Whitman's son died, she bid me to her home for the ceremony and gave me a set of four beautiful hand-painted Mexican dinner plates with a blue border. They'd been purchased on vacation by some faction of the extended family, brought home as a souvenir. I used them regularly until I learned of Esther's death. It seemed appropriate to put them away and let them rest a while, but when I recently hosted a brunch, I used one of them to hold the cream cheese, warmed myself with memories of her. If empathy is the highest form of knowledge, it is both bane and salvation in public health nursing. We're in our clients' homes week after week, teaching the intricacies of living with chronic ailments or prevention for disorders that are apt to develop. Some are preemies we watch advance from incubators and listlessness to the vivacity of three-year-olds, finally safe from SIDS, musculoskeletal deficits, developmental delay. Some are pregnant teens, drug users, alcoholics, victims of abuse. Change comes slowly, if at all. Only a public health nurse who stays in a community for decades will see fruits from her labors, usually in the form of the children of a pregnant teen for immunizations, WIC, and well child clinics, head lice, eventually STDs and birth control. More often than not, as they become mothers themselves. Some of my interactions were less intimate, less prolonged, more quickly gratifying. Sometimes a home visit involves showing up on a doorstep with 10 days of doxycycline for a known chlamydia contact, a young guy too embarrassed to return my calls or come to clinic. Some a little more difficult, stopping in to console parents trying to make sense of a daughter who snuck off to have an abortion, an IV drug user worried about his risk for HIV but more worried about the police. A public health nurse's goal is to inspire confidence and wellness behaviors. We become surrogate mothers, brothers, granddaughters. So when Stan called to say he couldn't rouse Peach, it was with the heart of a granddaughter that I grabbed tubes of glucose paste in my new nurse's bag, poked my head into Amanda Alford's station to tell her to send the ambulance. The trip up the blue vinyl stairs had become routine. I took them two at a time, fled past Candace with her mop bucket, a short-haired Nez Perce woman not 5 feet tall with a slightly muscular build. She kept the clinic orderly and sanitized, so efficiently that everyone called her Mom. Once in a while at the supermarket in Lewiston, I saw her and yelled, "Hey, Mom!" She yelled back, "I suppose you want money." Fellow shoppers looked from her to me, me to her. We laughed later, smug in the scene we created. The run from the front doors of the clinic to the parking lot had become equally familiar, as had the faces going in and out. Someone said, "Hey, Lautiwa," and it was Leonard Wahoban, his dark basketball player body leaning against the hood of a car, talking to a man I recognized as Silas Lawyer, one of the officials at the Nez Perce Tribal Fisheries, and a man who once said to me of Leonard, "In his early days, he could be quite the predator, eh?" I didn't doubt it a bit, and when I relayed the comment to Leonard, he had his own stories of Silas and their post-adolescent carousing. I drove out of the parking lot with hazard lights flashing, shedding rubber, and sped through town to the highway, horn honking like the geese I'd been hearing on their flight south from Canada. I should have gotten a verbal order for a bolus of D-50, a powerful injection of glucose solution. I should have grabbed an oxygen tank. Eddie Dakota in his old brown BIA sedan waving me on. Buzz Conkling, a tribal cop, in his prowl car also waving me on. They knew someone was in trouble. And so I finally had reason to bury the pedal down that creepy road. It was awesome. Four-wheel drive, dust rising and thunderheads obliterating all but the road ahead. Thick as talcum on the Cherokee's rear and side windows once I had stopped. Gravel loud as hail. Three kinds of adrenaline pumping as I pulled into the driveway. Horsepower, peach, dogs. One finger on my can of dog spray. I slammed the gear shift into park, grabbed my nursing bag. Both mutts were snarling, growling, the full length of their chains taut against the metal corkscrew stake, which surely this time was bound to stutter loose from the ground. Stan was standing in the carport with the screen open, waiting, looking oddly casual in a t-shirt, sweatpants, and moccasins. The flies were so thick around the trash they appeared to be mating midair. Summer was blazing, and Stan was letting out the air conditioning. "You'll run your electric bill up, Stan," I told him. "She's out," he said. "I can't help her. She's just out." Peach lay on an old-fashioned brown metal bedstead with blue roses painted on the middle of the headboard. She looked peaceful, as though in the midst of a best night's sleep ever. Her half of the vintage chenille bedspread with a similar rose pattern covered her to the chin. Stan's side was smoothed, the pillow tucked, completely made. The linoleum and remaining furniture was also vintage, well-oiled and obviously cared for. She didn't respond to the first tube of glucose paste I squeezed under her tongue, but she responded to the second. Within 10 minutes she was sitting, swallowing the paste made from table sugar and water I had sent Stan to the kitchen to make. Within 15, we had her drinking orange juice. "I want to go to the couch," Peach said. Stan helped her with the slippers. I helped pull her arms through an old house coat.
You've been listening to Paula Coomer, reading from her novel, Dove Creek.
Ollie, oxen free, come out from behind the tree. You and I were meant to be. Beautiful to me. You were always beautiful to me.
Dove Creek was produced by Nancy Casey and Paula Coomer with help from KRFP, a listener-supported non-commercial radio station at 92.5 FM in Moscow, Idaho. You can find KRFP on the web at krfp.org, where you can click on Dove Creek to learn more about this broadcast, sign up for a podcast, or send an email. There you can also contact Bill Finch, who wrote and performs our theme song.